Please welcome to the stage, for this Stanford's Travel Writers Festival, Tristan Cooley.
Thanks so much for that fantastic introduction. I feel like I should be leaping into a ring as a boxer or something. But thank you all for coming to this talk. That's your part of the deal. My part is I'm going to try and change the way you see the world forever. Not completely. You'll still be able to go about your daily lives, but I am going to try and change it just a tiny bit. Can you all see the screen above me here? There are going to be clues appearing on that over the next 3/4 hour. But let's get started. I'd like you all to imagine that you're on a walk on a cool morning and you pick up a smell. It's the faint smell of smoke. You look all around, there's not a fire anywhere you can see. I'm just going to give you a few seconds now to work out what that might be a clue to. It's not a fire, just a faint whiff of smoke. It's mixed in with the air. Have a little think. I'm not going to go quiet for long because it starts to feel a bit religious if I do that. But that scent of smoke is a sign of a weather phenomenon called a temperature inversion. Normally, the air gets colder as we get higher. That's why there's snow on the top of mountains and it's warm in valleys. But sometimes, warm air sits on top of cold air and it creates a sandwich effect. And this is called a temperature inversion. So what? This is what I so often think about natural clues. So what? And if there isn't a good answer, I bin it and I find another one. But there is a good answer to this one. The so what is, when there's a temperature inversion, it changes everything we can hear. So if you know an area well, you'll have got used to the idea that wind direction influences what you hear. But what this smell of smoke means there's a temperature inversion, which means you can hear much further. You'll hear trains that you can't normally, or airports, or motorways, or any loud sounds that you can't normally hear suddenly become audible in a temperature inversion. And it's not just what we hear, but everything that we see changes as well. If you look at this beautiful sunset, it's a photo I took in Oman, you'll notice the sun is squashed. But it looks beautiful, but it doesn't look that peculiar, does it? We're quite used to that quite beautiful effect. And that's because the air in this picture is normal. It's getting cooler as we get higher. And cool air is a different density to warm air, so it actually creates a lens which squashes the sun. So what? Well, that's a sign that normal weather is out there. So the chances are that whatever the season, wherever you are in the world, the following day is going to be normal for that place and season. But if you've picked up that scent of smoke, or you're hearing things much further away than you can normally, maybe there's a temperature inversion. And if there's a temperature inversion, everything you see, instead of getting squashed, gets stretched. And this is a great opportunity to see something called the green flash. Hands up if anybody's seen the green flash. One there, fantastic. That's about normal for a group this size. Not many people see it. Some people go their whole lives looking for it and not seeing it. But when the air is in a temperature inversion and it's stretching things vertically, just after the moment of sunset, there's a chance to see the green flash. The reds, oranges, and yellows can't reach you. The blues can't reach you. It's just for a fraction of a second you get a flash of green light. And this is what's got me really worked up over the past 10 years. Is this idea that this part of our brain is expected to shut down the second we go outdoors. If we think about all the detective stories, all the novels, you know, half the TV that's on in the evening, think about crossword puzzles, think about Sudoku. All of these things prove one thing. Human beings love a puzzle. We love clues and we love solving puzzles. But it's driven me mad for 10 years now that I love that stuff and I'm expected the moment I step outdoors to just turn that part of my brain off. Of course, lots of people, when they're outdoors, they want to relax. They don't want to do a lot of thinking, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But if you're one of those people who doesn't mind solving a puzzle outdoors, then this is the talk for you. To start solving puzzles, we've got to fire up the best tools we've got, the best tools we'll ever be given in our whole life, our senses. You think you can spend £10 on something today and it comes with an instruction manual in 18 different languages, none of which make any sense. But the best gadgets, the best tools we'll ever have are our senses. No instruction manual. So we have to kind of get you we have to work out how to use them to their full effect. If you look at this picture here, your eyes can tell, your eyes feed information to your brain, and you can work out which is the most distant hill. It's the highest one in this picture, but also it's the one that's lightest in color. So your eyes and your brain are doing a shortcut there. And we're doing this all day, every day. Our eyes spot something, our brain does a shortcut, and we don't actually even appreciate it. But as soon as we notice things like this, you can actually judge distance just by looking at colors. Not only can we deduce things, but we can also predict things. And let me give you an example. You know those days when you want to be outdoors, but the weather is far from perfect. There's a bit of rain, very dark clouds, but you persevere with your outdoors day. And then right at the end of the day, the sun peaks out. It's rather a nice moment. If it does that, all you've got to do is put your sun to the back, put the sun on your back and have a look at what's in front of you. And here's a picture I took in Wales, exactly that effect. Quite often we see something on our travels or on a walk through nature, and we're surprised by how beautiful it is. But once we know how some of these pieces work, we're not only not surprised, we actually know how to find them. So if there's a dark sky and the sun comes out late in the day, just put your back to the sun and whatever's in front of you will look amazing, luminous, almost technicolor, like this hill in Wales. Okay, it's time to get stuck into some actual specific clues. I'm sure you all recognize this plant here. Any offers? What have we got? Yeah, stinging nettle. Not everybody's favorite plant. Gardeners hate it, walkers hate it. It doesn't have a big fan club, the stinging nettle. But I'm about to change that. Well, I'm going to try very hard anyway. Every single plant is a clue to something because plants can't grow everywhere. They have a little niche, certain places they grow well, and that's kind of their home. The stinging nettle needs places that are high in nutrients, chemicals called nitrates and phosphates. So if we see a stinging nettle, it's saying a place has lots of nitrates and phosphates in the soil. So what? Well, one of the things about the only thing that makes the soil rich in phosphates and nitrates is the way human beings live, work, and die. The way we farm, the way we burn things, that changes the soil, which then means stinging nettles do well. So we've got used to thinking, oh, stinging nettles grow everywhere, but that's because they're growing where we are. And what use is that? Well, as a natural navigator, it's great fun, because if you're on a walk in the countryside, maybe heading to a village pub for lunch, and you're thinking, should I check the map? And then you spot the stinging nettles. Oh, I don't need to check the map. We haven't seen any stinging nettles for an hour, and suddenly there are loads of them. The village will be just over that hill. And it nearly always is. Okay, those of you who may have come across my work will know me for my love of natural navigation. And natural navigation is one of the most fun areas of outdoor clues. Every single thing we see outdoors can be both a map and a compass for us if we know enough about it, if we get to know it like a friend. And here's a challenge for you. Over the next 20 minutes, I want you to think of something you've seen outdoors, and hopefully we'll have a couple of minutes, if I don't bang on too long, hopefully we'll have a couple of minutes at the end, and if somebody's feeling brave, you can just throw that at me, and I'll see if I can just find one clue in it. If I can't, I can't, and I'll be honest, but it's quite a good challenge for both of us. Right, let's get back to these clues. You see this nice English oak tree? It's a photo I took in Sussex, where I live. Notice how the tree's not symmetrical. Of the however many billions of trees on planet Earth, there is not one symmetrical tree. And once we know that, we're well on our way to using it as a compass. All we have to do is put a couple of simple pieces together. The sun is due south in the middle of the day every day of the year. So there's a nice compass for you already. All plants need sunlight. It's their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And they get most of it in the middle of the day. So we just bring those pieces together. Every plant is getting most of its energy from the south. So they grow bigger, more abundant, stronger, more leafy on the southern side. So now when we look at this tree, it's not just a pretty tree, it's quite a clear compass. There's more tree on the right, which means the sun has been coming from, you know, where my hand is, quite a lot higher, but that side. So south is to the right, so we are looking from west to east. Here's another tree compass. There are loads of them, but we haven't got time for tons. I'll just give you a couple more, though. When there aren't so many leaves on the tree, you get to see the branches. On the south side of a tree, the branches grow towards the light. But on the north side of the tree, they're trying to grow towards the light as well. But because the light is coming from the south, this has a different effect. It creates what I call the tick effect. Can you see in this tree here? The branches on the right, more horizontal. The branches on the left are more vertical. So again, south is to the right. We are looking from west to east. And last tree clue for a bit, because we've got so much fun stuff to get into. These are two twigs I took from the same ash tree in August a few years ago. It's nothing to do with spring growth, this. Notice how the leaves on the left are smaller and lighter in colour. The leaves on the right are bigger and darker in colour. Trees have two types of leaves, sun leaves and shade leaves. The leaves in the shade are struggling. They want so much to have more light, to make more energy for the tree, but the light isn't there. So what they do is they compensate. The tree sends out a signal and they grow bigger, and the tree puts more chlorophyll in, which makes it darker green. So the twig on the right here is from the north side of the tree. The twig on the left is from the south side of the tree. Leaves as a compass. Okay, we've talked a bit about sunlight. One of the really important and really fun clues, and one of the ones that gets you into the subject really fast, is the wind. The wind can blow from any direction on any one day, but every single place in the world, there's a trend. And in the UK and a lot of Northwest Europe, the wind blows from the southwest more commonly than any other direction. And absolutely everything on Earth will reflect this. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a massive ocean, near the North Pole, in the center of London, in the desert. Once you know what the wind's been doing, once you know the trends, absolutely everywhere on Earth, and I challenge you to think of somewhere, there will be some form of wind clue. So what we find is the roots on the south side of trees, especially exposed ones, grow bigger, stronger, and longer. And we can notice this just above the ground. We don't have to go and dig the whole tree up. That wouldn't be much use. But as you can see in this illustration, all the black and white pictures are taken straight from the book. Let's have a look at one actually out there. Can you see three trees here? The one on the left and the one in the middle, they have these guy roots spreading out from the southwest. So where my hand is roughly southwest. But notice the one behind them on the right. It hasn't spread its roots out. So my guess is at some point over the next 10 or 20 years, a storm will take that beech tree on the right down. The other two will probably be okay. Okay, for thousands of years, human beings have got clues to navigating from animals. And pretty much every animal can help us understand where we are and can quite often give us clues where we need to go. We can actually do a quite fun twist on this idea by taking the idea of birds. Birds migrate from places dependably with the seasons. But we also migrate. That's why we're all here, isn't it? It's a holiday and travel show. It's about this time of year we think, yeah, a little bit of migrating wouldn't do me any harm at all, even if it is only for a week or two. Well, the birds are doing the same for their own survival. And we bring a couple of ideas together again. That's so often the way to find a fun clue outdoors. Aircraft quite often leave these white lines in the sky, artificial clouds called contrails, short for condensation trails. But just as the birds don't fly randomly, they know where they're going. The aircraft know where they're going, and there are patterns. So in the UK, if you see lots of these contrails in the sky, look for a trend. And most aircraft tend to be either going to the American continent or the European continent. So you'll find there's a northwest, southeast trend in the sky. So they've gone from funny little white lines to a compass for you. I've done a bit of natural navigation, but the world of outdoor clues is bigger than just natural navigation. So I want to take this same clue and look at it in a totally different way. Imagine you're outdoors for the best part of a day. You might be gardening, you might be on a long walk. It doesn't matter, but you've decided to try and spot some clues. Early in the day, you look up and you see a couple of aircraft go over and there are no contrails. You think, oh, there's nothing very extraordinary about that. 2 hours later, you look up and there are one or two contrails that then disappear after about 2 or 3 minutes. 2 hours after that, you look up and this is what you see. Well, there can only be one explanation for that, and that's the atmosphere has changed. These contrails will only form if there's a certain amount of moisture in the air. So what we can say if that happens is the air has grown moister, there's more water up there, which is a very good indicator that bad weather is approaching. So let's have a look at a couple of weather clues. I hope you've been relaxing and enjoying the talk, but now it's time for you guys to do a little bit of work for me. Have a look at these two clouds. I'll call cloud A is the cloud on the left, cloud B is the cloud on the right. I want all of you to have a think. I'm not going to pick on anybody, but do have a think. Which cloud would you be more worried about if you're outdoors and you spotted it? Cloud A or cloud B? Have a bit of a think. Okay, hands up if you picked cloud A. Okay, hands up if you picked cloud B. Hands up if you read my book and then picked... No, that's cheating. these are in the book. So, the good news is, no shame for anybody. These are both clouds we want to be thinking about. They're both clouds that could be a concern, because the one on the left is quite tall, and a tall cloud is a sign that the atmosphere is not stable. That the air is moving up and down, which is a sign that all sorts of things may happen. But that cloud is not an imminent threat. And the reason is, if we look at the top of the cloud, can you see it looks a bit like a cauliflower? It's got like cauliflower florets. And when you've got definition, shape you can actually see at the top of a cloud, these florets, it means the cloud is still all water. And a cloud that is all water can't do anything really nasty. However, the cloud on the right, cloud B, it's another tall cloud, although it's not immediately obvious in the picture, but look at the top of it. Can you see how there's no cauliflower florets there? It's gone all wispy, more like candy floss. This is a sign that the water has turned to ice. When you've got a tall cloud with ice at the top, the ice gets heavy, it falls, the warm air pushes it up, a cycle starts which leads to, bang, a thunderstorm. Very shortly after I took the picture on the right, we were evacuated from La Palma Airport in the Canaries for 48 hours. Hopefully the lighting is okay, and can you see this rainbow here? Now, one of the wonderful things about outdoor clues is they don't take any of the beauty away. If we see a rainbow, it's still just as beautiful if we learn how to read it. But everything outdoors is a clue. So we can see the rainbow, we can admire its beauty, and we can use it to do some quite fun things. How do we do that? Well, don't worry about this. I'm not going to drag you through some prep school maths lesson. It's all very, very fun, straightforward stuff. A rainbow forms opposite the sun. And if you imagine a rainbow as part of a circle, then the center of that imaginary circle will be directly opposite the sun, a point known as the antisolar point. In simple terms, rainbows form opposite the sun. They also form when the sun is relatively low, which is the start and the end of the day. Most of our weather comes from the west. So lots and lots of simple pieces. Suddenly, if we see a rainbow late in the day, it means the sun is west of us and the water is right of us. Ah, the weather's about to get better. If we see a rainbow early in the day, the weather's probably about to get worse quite quickly. But we can do so much better than that. Because of this basic understanding of how rainbows form, once we know that we can use the sun for all sorts of things, we can use the sun to navigate, we can use the sun to tell the time, we can use the sun to work out how long it is till sunset, we can do all of those things with a rainbow. It doesn't happen very often, I'll be honest with you, but at least a couple of times in my life, I've used a rainbow to find my way. Because it's surprisingly common to see a rainbow without being able to see the sun. It's got to be out there somewhere, otherwise the rainbow wouldn't form. But quite often it's behind buildings or behind woodland. It's creating the rainbow, you can't see it, but then you can use the rainbow to navigate. And we can actually go one level above that. Every single color in a rainbow is being created by raindrops. But depending on the size and shape of the raindrops, that will influence the colors in the rainbow. Or, to put it another way, every color in the rainbow is telling you something about the rain. Now, in the book, I go through each of the colors, and they are all telling you something. But to keep it simple, lots of red means a wet head. If we look at this rainbow here, if you can spot it, can you see how there's a bit more red to the left and a little bit less red in the right, and the rainbow is much weaker in color on the right? Well, we're not only able to use that rainbow to navigate, to tell the time, to work out how long till sunset, we can actually use it to work out that the raindrops on the left are much bigger than the raindrops on the right. They're probably those big dollops that run down the back of your neck. Okay, a crescent moon. Now, there are some fiendishly difficult ways to navigate using the moon. There's one I've been working on for 8 years, and I'm still not happy with it, so I haven't put it out in the public domain yet. to me, it's going to be my, I don't know, it'll probably be my swan song. It'll be something I whisper from my deathbed to somebody, you know, after I've been working on it for a few years more, I hope. But there are also some really nice, easy clues from the moon. If you see a crescent moon, just in your mind, draw a line that touches the horns that runs from here to here, and you extend that down to the ground, and that will give you a rough indication of south. So often when I'm teaching things outdoors, it's this so what idea. You know, I think I learned it off kids, actually. You know, if you say something and they go, so what? It's tempting to go, but don't you see the beauty I see? But it's a very valid question. So all the work I do with outdoor stuff, I'm constantly asking myself that, so what? So when people have said for years, oh, isn't the moon beautiful? Yeah, it's beautiful, but give me something else to work with, you know. So that's what I'm doing all the time, is instead of saying to people, you should appreciate this, you will find this, you know, give people challenges. Here's a fun one. We all know, you know, the moon is beautiful and it has these light bits and these dark bits. It has craters or seas or whatever we want to call them. But that tends to be where our interest stops. But as soon as you make a bit of a challenge to see how good your eyesight is, you can use the moon as a clue to how good your long-distance vision is. And there's an astronomer called Pickering who numbered features 1 to 12, as you can see them here. 1, pretty much everybody can see unless they've got very impaired vision. 12 is deemed just impossible to see with the naked human eye. So, you know, with someone else, you go out there and just see which ones you can see. And suddenly it feels like you're exploring another world. Instead of letting your brain charge on to something less important, less interesting, like emails and deadlines and all this other nonsense, you know, noticing features on the moon, nothing more important than that, in my humble opinion. You'll all be familiar with the idea that we can navigate using the stars. A lot of people think it's complex. Working out exactly where you are using the stars takes practice and skill using something called a sextant, which you'll be familiar with. The BBC once blindfolded me, stuck me on a boat, took me out in the English Channel, took the blindfold off, and had to work out exactly where I was. And it was only because of years of practice that that was fun rather than tricky. But the good news is, to get up and running, finding direction using the stars could not be easier. Have a look at this constellation here. It's one you will all have seen hundreds of times, even if you don't know it by name. By the way, names are not important. So many people are put off nature and the outdoors by names. Names of stars, names of plants, names of animals. If they help you, they help you. If they don't, they don't. Names are not important. This has, you know, 100 different names all across the world. Which one is right? None of them. Call it whatever you want. The most common name is Orion. And you would probably be most familiar with Orion's Belt. It's the only place in the night sky where 3 relatively bright stars form a short straight line. So what? Orion rises in the east, sets in the west. The belt rises very close to due east and sets very close to due west. And this star here happens to be called Mintaka, rises within 1 degree of due east and sets within 1 degree of due west. So you can make it really accurate, but to get up and running, if this is new to you, when you see Orion near the horizon, you're looking east or west. If after 20 minutes it's gone up a bit, you're looking east, and if it's gone down a bit, you're looking west. If you weren't before, you are all now astro-navigators. I mean it sincerely. That's how it starts. You'll all have heard of the North Star. We can use, the Americans call it the Big Dipper. In the UK, we tend to call it the Plow. We can use a shape to find the North Star, and then we're looking north. But we can also tell the time using the stars. Sadly, I don't have the time, ironically, right now to go through all the steps, but basically, if we draw a line from the North Star to the Plough or the Big Dipper, that's one hand of a clock. And then with a bit of simple arithmetic, you can get within a quarter of an hour of the time. And you're all probably quite rightly sitting there, yeah, but my watch is a bit more accurate than that. My iPhone's even more accurate than that. So do I need to do that? No. Is it fun? Yes. Okay. Shout out. What is this plant here, a leaf from? Yeah, ivy, brilliant. And what is this from? A little bit quieter, but there was definitely an ivy there. Well done, whoever that was. I love ivy, because ivy sort of shows to me how I'm learning. And that's the reason I do this slightly unusual job, is learning. I get derive such pleasure from learning new things. Ivy teased me for years and years and years. Every time I went out, I'm always out there. I'm looking for patterns. I'm looking for clues. I'm looking for asymmetries. Every time I thought ivy was whispering to me what its secret was, I'd go out the next day and it'd do completely the opposite. Well, it's because Ivy has two stages of life, and it behaves in a totally opposite way in terms of growth in its second stage. When it's young, it's very easy to spot. It has more than one point in its leaves. And then when it becomes mature, on average about 10 years, but it's more to do with height and light levels, and scientists aren't sure exactly when it happens. But when it becomes mature, it's very easy to spot one point in the leaf. So what? Well, here we go. When ivy is young, it's around the base of a tree or a wall. It's what botanists call negatively phototropic, and what English speakers call grows away from the light. So here, it's a bit of a subtle effect, but can you see we're looking from south to north? Can you see how the ivy is trying to grow away from us around the base? It's often a bit easier to spot on the other side of the tree. Can you see here it's growing towards us? And then, when it reaches maturity, the game changes. Instead of trying to cling on to things and grow away from the light, it grows away from the light to cling on to things. It grows bushy and much more like a normal tree, much more like the oak tree we saw earlier in the talk. So here, have a think about which way we're looking. It grows bushy, it grows towards the light, it becomes positively phototropic. So if you've all got your own answer in your head, from here, again, we're looking from west to east because it's growing out to the right. It's growing towards the light, which is where I'm standing. If you ask people who've never come across natural navigation, you know, what is it? You're likely to get some blank faces, but if people volunteer an answer, quite often the one is, well, that's moss growing on the north side of things. Like that wraps up, you know, one whole area of human endeavor for the past several thousand years. Well, this is a picture I took in Wisman's Wood in Dartmoor. Good luck with that method. Moss is not in my top 20 techniques. It does give us clues. It loves moisture. So wherever you see moss growing, it's a place that stays moist. Hence, in Dartmoor, there's no shortage of it. So I wouldn't recommend moss as a place to get started with this subject. Lichens, however, fantastic. Probably one of my favorite organisms in the world. When I took that photo of the cloud, I was trying to get off La Palma after doing a natural navigation test, climbing into this volcanic caldera and trying to get myself lost and then get myself out again. And there was this lichen here. As the afternoon mist came in, I'd noticed this lichen. I'd made friends with it. That's the sort of person I am. This lichen thriving on the northwest side of these igneous volcanic rocks. So it was no problem at all. And if we notice these things in nature, they are all trying to help us. And here, my favorite lichen in the whole world, Xanthoria, from the ancient Greek word for blonde or golden. It needs light and it needs nutrients. It's a double clue. Nutrients part, not so interesting. All it's really telling us is this is a post that dogs like to pee on. We can live without that clue. But the light one is great. Because if we look down the right side of this post here, can you see it's bare? No lichens on it. Not enough light. Because that's the north side of the post. Remember, the sun is due south in the middle of the day, every day of the year in this part of the world. When we come round here, the lichens are having a good go. They're not thriving, but they're having a good go. And can you see how they're a pale, grey, greeny, sort of yellowy colour? You know, they're a bit sort of lacking in lustre. And then when we come all the way around to the left side of the post, a wonderful golden colour. Xanthoria is a colour compass. So in this picture, we can't see west, but that's the south, that's the east, and that's the north side. You'll see this lichen. This is a sort of thing that quite often makes the penny drop for people because, you know, within a stone's throw of this hall, you know, there's tons and tons of this stuff. You walk, you know, you've probably seen this, I don't know, 10,000 times in your life, but your brain's telling you that something else is more interesting or more important. Nothing is more important than lichens. Let me tell you that now. Okay, anything that has a relationship with the sun can give you a clue to direction. Would you like a very long sentence that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever? I didn't think so, but I'm going to give you one anyway, and it's about churches. Churches tend to align from west to east, with the altar at the eastern end, but the entrance at the western end, but the door on the southern side, because people like to approach from the south. This is why the church is normally on the north side of roads, and why the graveyards tend to be bigger on the south side. People prefer to be buried on the south side. The graves themselves will have the stone at the western end, the feet at the eastern end, except for the clergy will be buried. You get the idea. I will spare you any more. But anything that has a relationship with the sun can be used to help you find your way. Sundials, very common on rural churches on the south side. And the pointy bit, the bit that casts a shadow, must point south. The gnomon must point south, otherwise it can't tell the time. But But it's not just old-fashioned natural clues. Anything that has a relationship with the sun is trying to whisper direction to you. So this is either a south-facing roof or it's somebody who's wasting an awful lot of money they're not going to see back. The beady-eyed amongst you will have spotted, nestled in amongst the solar panels, a TV satellite dish. They all have trends all over the world, so wherever you're traveling, try and pick up what the trend is and it'll help you for the rest of your stay. To get you going, though, to get you used to this method, in the UK, they tend to point close to southeast. I'm very fortunate this this line of work has taken me to some fascinating places. In 2009, I walked across 100 miles of the Libyan Sahara with two Tuareg nomads, and I was studying their methods and looking at how they found their way by understanding the relationship between wind and sand. Remember, wind, really important. So in this picture, if I took two steps to the left, I'd be on the slip face. That's the downwind side. Very hard to walk. I'd probably fall over. So I'm on the windward side. Again, if you know where the wind has come from, every single sand dune is a compass. But the lovely thing is that the Tuareg were able to teach me a technique using this on a microscopic level almost. You see, these mini dunes aren't even as high as my fingers. So I got asked to go out to Oman and teach Omanis. I mean, it's crazy. It's Coles to Newcastle stuff. But I got taken out to Oman to teach Omanis how to find their way using sand and stars. And I was able to borrow knowledge from the Tuareg and give it back to the Omanis because it's ebbing the knowledge there. So here the wind has come from the left to the right. You can see the sand has dropped out by that grass tussock there. And you can see these mini dunes. But the truth is, the beautiful thing about natural navigation is none of these clues are limited to far off places. This is a picture I took in my nearest beach. I live in West Sussex. This is West Wittering Beach in West Sussex. Little ripples, little dunes. Again, just touch each side of the dune. The firm side will be the side the wind has come from, a clue to southwest. So we can use Tuareg methods. They've come via Oman back to us here. We can use them on a British beach. Same is true of snow. It's a picture I took in the Scottish Highlands. And what looked like Yeti footprints, if we zoom in a bit, can you see there's actually a tongue of ice? And the wind is sculpting the ice. The Inuit have known this for centuries, and they use the shape of ice tongues as compasses. In fact, they get to know the character of the prevailing wind so well that by looking at the tongue, they can tell which wind created it. And they actually give these winds characters. There are male ones and female ones, different names, and within that, they know where the wind has come from and therefore how to find their way just from the shape of ice. A lot of the feedback I've had from people who are still trying to use natural navigation there aren't many, I'll be honest, this is more about fun and interest, but there are a small number of people who still have to use natural navigation in a life or death situation. And the feedback I get from them, from the military and others, is that the rainforest, the jungle, is where it's still critical. GPS doesn't work under a wet rainforest canopy, and the maps in jungles tend to be truly awful. So actually understanding how nature is guiding us is really important. So a couple of years ago, I put together an expedition, traveled into the heart of Borneo. It took 8 days in these small canoes. Probably sounds idyllic, but if anybody here tries to sell you 8 days in one of these, tell them where to go. The first 8 minutes is really lovely. Absolutely gorgeous. Little putt-putt engine on the back, going up the river, nothing nicer. But after about a day, that's enough. After 8 days sitting cross-legged on a hard floor, driving rain most of the time. But it was well worth it, even with the local cuisine. I lived off frogs for a large part of it and got to know some of the other wonderful wildlife. I was probably pulling a leech off once every 2 or 3 hours. This shirt ended up crimson and had to be, was torn to shreds, had to be discarded. But it was all worth it to meet these guys, this man in particular, Titus Penandiak, and study how he found his way. And in the book, there are 2 chapters about everything, about that journey and what he taught me. But to give you a nugget here, they don't think of north, south, east, west. They think about uphill, downhill, upriver, downriver. So if you say to them stuff like, you know, where's the pub? They won't go turn left. Even on what appears flat terrain, they'd say, go uphill or go upriver. Even if the river is a mile away, they'll still say head upriver because that's the way they see the world. The real point of all of this, though, is to banish the ordinary. Once you start thinking that everything outdoors is a clue, the ordinary becomes impossible and it becomes the extraordinary. So this scene here, which your brain is trying to tell you is ordinary, there's a nice house, there's a tree, move on, nothing to see here. Once we think, which way am I looking? Where are the clues? Every single one of these asterisks is a clue. In fact, these are just clues to natural navigation. And even with natural navigation, I've been quite sparing because the tree has 19 natural navigation clues on it. But I didn't want to, you know, blitz it with a blizzard. But just to give you a flavor of how deep this code is that we can crack and have fun, if you have a look at this picture, can you see how there's slightly more light on this side of the dormer window? And we can see the sun here. Well, using the various clues there, you can work out the sun is setting. That light on the right side is coming from the moon, even though we can't see it. The moon is rising as the sun is setting, which means it's a full moon. And some of you will be aware, near a full moon, we get spring tides. These are the greatest tidal ranges. And not just, this picture was taken in the home counties, not just in England, but all over the world. So by noticing a little bit of light on one side of a window, on a house in the home counties, you can work out what the tides are doing in the Pacific and all over the world. And this really is where it gets exciting, is where these pieces start to come together. To get into the subject, start with a couple of nice, simple clues. Find south using a tree. But once you've had a bit of fun with it, it doesn't take long, the clues start to overlap. And then you start to spot the incredible matrix that's out there. Let me give you an example as we wrap up. You're on a walk to a village pub for lunch again, and you spot a butterfly, and you admire its beauty. Ah, the peacock butterfly. None of the beauty is gone, but you just think, what is it trying to tell me? And then you remember, peacock butterflies need stinging nettles for large parts of their life cycle. Stinging nettles are a clue to civilization. So the peacock butterfly is trying to tell you to get your drinks order ready because the pub is around the corner. Thank you very much, everybody. I've really enjoyed speaking here today, and you've been a great audience. I have no idea how I did with time. How are we doing? Yeah, we're good for a couple of questions? Excellent. So I challenge you at the beginning to think of anything you want outdoors, and I'll be honest, if I can't come up with a clue, I can't. But if you've got a question on anything else, I'd be delighted to... Okay. Oh, there's a mic heading.
Hi there. Great talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
At the beginning, you mentioned the temperature inversion and this smell of smoke, but there was no fire. Yep. But could you just explain what the smell of smoke is?
Yes. Situation? It's a very good question and very politely put that I'd forgotten a rather important part of the beginning part of the talk. Well done, sir. The smoke comes from all the normal sources, home fires and business fire, work fires, industry fires, outdoor fires. But it gets stuck in the sandwich layer and it just becomes mixed up. And that's why it's that musty smell. I think we all know that difference. You know, the strong, harsh smell, you go, wow, there's probably a fire within a few hundred meters on me. And then you can just get that musty. Somebody somewhere is having a fire, you know, it's mixed in. So it's the same sources of smoke normally. It's just could well be, you know, 2 or 3 miles away. Thanks.
Who's next?
There was one here, sorry.
I'm coming.
So I was out walking about 3 or 4 weeks ago, very sunny, and you were saying about rainbows being in the morning or the afternoon. It was about lunchtime, sunny, hadn't been raining all day, didn't rain for the rest of the day, and I saw a rainbow in the sky, which was actually upside down. So it
yes.
wasn't going,
yes.
it was just kind of, and the yes. sun was behind that way and it was there.
Okay, great. Yeah, really, really lovely question. Something that doesn't fit the normal, did you see colours within it?
Yeah.
So something that doesn't fit, an upside down rainbow with colours, yeah. If I can borrow my own book for a second. I will explain as I try and find it. This you won't all be able to see, but this is a diagram of something known as the Seven Sons of Helvellius. And what happens is basically whenever you spot anything, the sun doing anything, whether it's a rainbow, something called a sun dog, which you will all have spotted even if you weren't aware of exactly what you're looking at, is either side of the sun. Sometimes the sun's light hits ice crystals and creates colours. But the long and the short of it is, you can get all of these incredible patterns in the sky, and they're all related. It's nearly always to do with ice crystals, the ones you're talking about. So they've got wonderful names like circumzenithal arcs and all these sorts of things. In clue terms, there's a sign that there are high clouds out there, typically things like cirrostratus, And in weather forecasting terms, cirrus stratus is at the front of a warm front. So if you've had a couple of days of good weather, suddenly you see amazing arcs everywhere. Keep your eyes peeled, because the chances are the weather's about to change within 4 or 5 hours.
Anyone else? Hands? I'm looking for a hand.
Time for one or two more? Somebody must have spotted something outdoors.
I want to know about the red sky at night, Shepherd's Delight. Is that bunkum or is that true?
No. In the book, I go through weather lore and I debunk some things and I underline some things as being solid. And red sky at night is one of the more dependable ones. And again, like so many of these clues, you just take two simple things, bolt them together, and you have something quite useful. So red sky at night is incredibly simple. It means we can see very far into the west. You know, if there are loads of clouds in the west, we don't see any red sky at all. So if you think about it, you are seeing all the way to the sun. So there are no low clouds between you and the sun. The other piece, very straightforward, most of our weather comes from the west. So we put those two pieces together. There's very, very clear skies, particularly in the lower area, in the direction the weather's coming from. So it's not bulletproof. Like all of these things, the weather could temporarily be coming from the east, in which case red sky at night won't help you at all. But on average, red sky at night is fairly dependable.
And I've noticed often that midges hang in the air, usually when it's been a nice evening. Are they any indicator of anything, or do they just happen to be out?
Yeah, I mean, all insects, it's a wonderful and complex area, and there are specialists who could do that question more justice than I can. But by and large, insects are at the most sensitive scale in terms of temperature, humidity, even light. So, for example, fly fishermen, in my latest book, I write a little bit about how fly fishermen, you know, at the very top end of their game, become aware that when a cloud goes in front of the sun, there are certain insects that are losing that heat, will literally fall out of the air onto a river, and the fish are tuned to that as well. So much of, you know, expertise outdoors, people who don't understand fishermen think that it's just an excuse to drink pink gin for 8 hours. It's that as well. But it's tuning into all these things, understanding that, you know, where a midge is will be a reflection of temperature, humidity, wind. If the wind picks up, the midges won't be there. And all of these things. In certain parts of the world, like the Scottish Highlands, it becomes a real dark art, you know, to the minute of where the midges will be. But even if, you know, there's no way, and I'm delighted to say this, there's no way that one person, even if I dedicate my life to it, can understand all the different clues. But the philosophy that helps is nothing's really there by accident. It's there because the conditions are right for it, so it's trying to tell us something. And so what I'd encourage people to do is, if they spot a pattern, just sort of go, oh, that's interesting. I've noticed that the midges come out, you know, just before the sun does or just after the sun does. And then the next time you notice that pattern, it's really satisfying because you feel like you've got one more piece of a jigsaw that's the size of, you know, this hall. Thanks. We've got another one or two here.
That's related to the height at which swifts are flying. When the pressure is higher, I think the midges are higher, the swifts are higher. So if you see swifts flying high,
and swallows, the weather's better. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, the bigger the animal, generally the more steps below it that it's. So if we think about the peacock butterflies depending on stinging nettles, we can think of the birds and the insects. So yes, that's another bit of lore that does hold some truth. That as the air pressure drops and the conditions deteriorate, the insects tend to drop lower, which in turn makes the birds go lower as well. So yeah, you're right.
And I think we've just got time for one more question.
Could you just walk me through the North Star and the Big Dipper and telling the time? What's your actual starting point?
Okay, sure. If I've got time, I'll just get back to that slide. The starting point is the Earth is spinning in space. So if we take the best tip I can give you is if you're getting into using the stars for practical things, is pretend the sun doesn't exist, because at the time you're looking at the stars, it doesn't. So what we do is the Earth is spinning in space, and if you basically, you can do this experiment for yourself, maybe not all of you right at the same time, but basically if I stand here now and turn around like that, it appears like these lights, which can be our stars, are spinning above me. That is effectively what's happening. We're sitting on the Earth, which is spinning, which makes the lights appear to do that. And since we are spinning approximately once every 24 hours, there's a tiny bit more to it, it's actually 23 hours and 56 minutes, but we don't worry about that now. All you have to do is have a start point, so a date when you know that things, what time things are, where things are pointing, and then all you do is a little bit of arithmetic. So you draw a line from the North Star out through the plough, the pointers on the plough. The date I use, but there are lots of ones you can use, is the 7th of March. It's all set out in the book. And then the clock runs 4 minutes fast for every day after the 7th of March. So if, for example, the hand is pointing at 10 p.m. on the 7th of March, simple. But if it's pointing at 10 p.m. on the 21st of March, 2 weeks on, you subtract half an hour, or an hour rather, so it'd actually be 9 p.m. But I hope that sort of, gives some idea. Great.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. That's been absolutely fascinating. Let's say thank you to Tristan Gooley.
Thanks very much, everybody, for coming. Enjoy the rest of the show. Cheers.